Welcome to New Books in Film. I am your host, Joel Cherney. 30 years ago, Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale developed a film that became the highest-grossing movie of 1985 and led to two popular sequels. Back to the Future appeared out of the blue to capture the attention of moviegoers. In his book, We Don't Need Roads, The Making of the Back to the Future Trilogy, writer Cassine Gaines has written a great overview of the series, from its earliest development through the filming and release of the three movies. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Cassine Gaines. Hi, Cassine. Thank you for talking to me.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
No problem. A lot of the podcast episodes I've done are people who've written academic books of film on film, but I also like talking to popular authors or people who, you know, who wrote books that are geared not necessarily just for academics. And I appreciate that your book was so timely, given that the number of anniversaries that we have related to the Back to the Future trilogy. But let's start with some background. You've written before on other films and shows, but what is your education and how did you lead into writing regularly on popular culture?
Well, I went to college at Rutgers University, and I triple majored, and actually my which I don't recommend. if people are listening who haven't gone to school yet, I don't recommend triple majoring, but it sort of uniquely positioned me to write these popular culture books. I majored in English, journalism and media studies, and American studies. And for those who don't know, American studies is sort of like sociology and history mixed together. It's sort of the easiest way to explain it. And what that sort of enabled me to do, I also teach high school English, and I've always sort of had an interest in looking at popular culture as cultural history. The distinction that I sort of make is, it's easy to sort of say Friends was a television show that was very popular and ran for 10 years, and it's another thing to sort of ask why and what was going on in our nation at the time to create a situation where that show was so successful and resonated with so much of the public. So my first book was on Pee-wee's Playhouse, which I thought was an interesting subject. I grew up watching Pee-wee Herman, and again, it was an interesting sort of question for me how Paul Reubens' Pee-wee Herman character came out of nowhere, was this huge phenomenon for a couple of years, and then has sort of become this footnote or punchline, depending on who you ask. And then I wrote on the A Christmas Story film, and again, it was a similar sort of thing. That was a film that is really rooted in 1940s Americana, but resonates with so many people still to this day. And what is it about either the 1940s or about what's going on in the world today that makes us nostalgic for the 1940s? So when it came to Back to the Future, I certainly was very aware of the anniversaries. I'm a big Back to the Future fan. I've been looking forward to 2015 my entire life because of the connections to the film. But Back to the Future is immensely popular around the world, and that was something that was interesting to me. And also, at the point in Robert Zemeckis, who was the director, and Bob Gale, who was his collaborator and producer and writer, at the point in their career, how did they make this film or these three films that were so popular, so well done? And really, it was unusual, given the circumstances, that this film succeeded. So I was interested in telling that story and looking at that.
That's interesting that you mentioned A Christmas Story. I grew up in Cleveland, spent most of my life there, although I live in Alabama now. So, of course, I was around when they were filming in downtown Cleveland. Memory serves, I think they did most of that filming in March. And so it was interesting riding the bus past Public Square and seeing all the Christmas decorations still up.
You got it.
And, of course, they kept the Christmas decorations up in the Higbee store at the time. And it's no longer a Higbee's. In fact, it's a casino now.
But right.
It was, and I know the Christmas Story house is very popular in Cleveland. So when I saw that, I said, well, there's another book that I've not read it, but it's definitely going to be something I'm going to reach out to. So what led you to this project? Was it your idea, or did somebody reach out to you and ask if you wanted to write about it?
No, this project was my idea, and it was something that really came out of my own curiosity and interest in this story. Because Back to the Future is so popular and has been really consistently the last 30 years, a lot has been written on it. There's a lot of DVD and Blu-ray special features. A lot of the cast and crew are forthcoming with interviews. But the more I looked for information, the more it seemed like there were what I refer to as stock stories. There were certain, you know, bite-sized stories that people had told over and over again, and they had sort of become a part of this Back to the Future mythos. And it always seemed to me that there was more going on beyond those stories. The best example that I can sort of give is I had known, like a lot of Back to the Future fans, that Eric Stoltz was originally cast as Marty McFly before Michael J. Fox was hired. But I know that he was a little bit too serious for the role and that ultimately they let him go. But I did not know, and I was curious about what it was like for the other actors working with Eric Stoltz. How were the other actors and crew members affected when Eric Stoltz was let go? Did they feel like the film was going to be DOA because they had just fired their lead actor? Or were they excited about having Michael J. Fox on board? And none of those questions had been answered in any of the interviews that I had seen, you know, conducted over the last 30 years. So questions like those led me to considering developing this into a full-length book project.
You seem to have a good relationship with many people related to the series when you speaking of your, of the people you talk to, and we'll talk about that in a minute, because you definitely received a lot of information particularly related to that story and some of the other story. But what's your experience with the films? In the introduction, you talk a little bit about it, and I think it was an interesting story about how you came to the Back to the Future films. So when did you first see them?
I first saw the Back to the Future films when I was elementary school aged, and I was sent home from school sick. I remember it very, very vividly, actually. I was sent home sick, and my parents both worked during the day. So I have an aunt who worked nights at the time, and she was responsible for picking me up. We went back to her house, and she had just purchased the Back to the Future trilogy, which actually came with a little VHS called The Secrets of the Back to the Future trilogy. That was a television special that was hosted by Kirk Cameron. And she says, "I think you'll like this," and puts it on. And before the movie's even on, I remember studying the cardboard VHS sleeve, looking at the beautiful poster art done by Drew Struzan. Just being captivated by it. I never seen a DeLorean before. I recognized Michael J. Fox from TV, but didn't really know who he was. I mean, I was a young kid. I was probably 4 or 5. But I watched the first film. I watched the second one. I watched the third one. So actually, I had a triple feature was my first time watching it. And I could not wait to get to school the next day and tell everyone about Back to the Future. You know, I actually remember quite a bit as a young kid seeing movies or TV shows, watching The Twilight Zone, and then going back and I had some friends of mine that were like into reading or whatever would like just share stories, you know, just like paraphrase or summarize these books or TV shows that we saw. So I remember sort of holding court and going through all of the beats of the Back to the Future trilogy during lunch. And then we played, you know, Back to the Future. We had this playset in the yard and with a steering wheel, and we would pretend to get it up to 88, and then we would go, "Oh, we're back in the dinosaur time," and, you know, run around, and it was just a lot of fun.
I was lucky enough to have actually seen that. I'm a little older than you, so I saw the first film in the theater. And I still remember going to see it not knowing what to expect, because obviously, as you illustrate quite well in the book, the making of it and the changes of release dates happen so often. Plus, it came out in a part of the summer that even back then was less important for summer movies. You didn't tend to bring out summer movies that late into the summer and hope that you would get enough interest. But yet I still remember going to see it without a real knowledge of what to expect. I know Spielberg's name, and by 85, Spielberg was already pretty well known. Mm-hmm. But then I remember walking out of the theater just totally shocked by what I had seen, because it was just so different from a lot of the movies. It was fresh and there were so many good aspects. So I could see how it would have even affected you at your younger age.
And as a kid, you don't know, you still don't totally know what is real and what is possible. You know, so when I saw the DeLorean disappear, I'm sure I had a sense that time travel was not real, but I really believed they made that car disappear. when I saw hoverboards in Back to the Future Part 2, there wasn't a doubt in my mind that hoverboards were real. And
you weren't the only one, as you point out in the book.
Yes, and there are still lots of people today still hoping for hoverboards. I just saw an article today that Lexus perhaps has invented a hoverboard. But it's really, you know, not to change gears too much, but I think one of the things that why those films connected so immediately is because so many of the effects are practical, as opposed to something like Jurassic World, which is very popular right now, but it's so much of it is CGI. You know, something like Spider-Man, so much of it is CGI. The Avengers, so much is CGI. You look at those Star Wars prequels, so much of it is CGI. And so the more, yes, you can do more with the medium that way, but it also makes it hard for an audience to really buy in. I mean, it's captivating to watch, but it's not realistic to watch. And it's harder for people to sort of imagine themselves in that time and space. It's very easy to watch Back to the Future and imagine yourself in Marty McFly's shoes.
Yeah, because it came out, as you point out, it came out at just at the tail end of where before CGA started to really take over more and more often in films, and it was definitely on the same level as we saw with, say, the Indiana Jones movies and even the initial Star Wars movies, where you could tell a lot of the effects were live or close to live, and Back to the Future. So things like flames, you know, you just feel like those are real flames and things like that. So
right.
And so that is not a big surprise that that would be something that would be interesting, even though, as you also point out in the book, Bob Zemeckis wasn't overly happy with the first movie's effects in some cases because they rushed it so much to get it out.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely. That's one of the things, you know, the more I spoke with people about Back to the Future and what transpired on set, and certainly with the release dates and all the things that you alluded to, the more impressive it is that film is coherent and fantastic. I mean, you know, it's there are much worse films that had a much easier time getting made, you know, and it's such a testament to the crew that they assembled and to Bob Zemeckis as a leader for really bringing that film to what materialized on screen.
Big part of that may be because you had the two people, even though they were young as far as filmmaking was concerned, and specifically the two Bobs, as you refer to them, but particularly Bob Zemeckis, they were able to do what they wanted to do without a lot of hand-holding, or more importantly, without a huge amount of oversight by another group. So it was a much more of a single-vision film and series than even back then was happening. And I think having Steven Spielberg behind you definitely helped them to be able to put together a film and film series that was so well thought out and constructed.
Yes, and actually that's something, it's mentioned briefly in the book, but it's an important point that I think you're getting at. Sid Sheinberg, who was an executive at Universal, took a particular interest in Steven Spielberg, especially after E.T. And, but that's not true. Before certainly before E.T. But he had a particular interest in Steven Spielberg and Spielberg's work. And so Sid Sheinberg was much more willing than probably any other studio executive with any other set of filmmakers to do things like agree to let Eric Stoltz go, even though it was going to cost the studio almost $4 million to do so. You know, when I spoke with Sid Sheinberg for this book, and I asked him about this decision to, you know, was it hard for you to agree to let them recast the part of Marty McFly? Sid Sheinberg's response was, well, what would you do if you had the most talented director that you had ever worked with in terms of Steven Spielberg, he was talking about the most talented director that you had ever worked with coming in and saying, I don't think this film is going to be good unless we make a change. You make the change. I mean, you know, it was, I had the utmost confidence in Steven, and Steven had the utmost confidence in Bob Zemeckis. And so, you know, again, when you talk about this perfect storm that made these films great, it just so happened to be a perfect team that was assembled that would enable Sid Sheinberg to say, yes, let's make the change.
I interviewed a while back, I interviewed the author of a book on Duel, Steven Spielberg's TV movie. And one of the things that came out in reading that book and talking to the author was the same concept where Spielberg in that case was able to show that he knew what he was doing, that he had a good vision, and that it took him a little bit of time to get the crew to go with him. But once they did, it was a group of people who seemed to know what they were doing. And it's one of the reasons why he was so successful even that back then. So it's not a surprise that he took the same tack towards Bob Zemeckis and that crew, where he felt they know what they're doing. We're going to let them do it. Where was Spielberg's relationship with Zemeckis? When did he first work with him?
Steven Spielberg met Bob Zemeckis. As Steven Spielberg was working on Sugarland Express, he had a test screen. I don't know if it was a test screening or just went to go show the film and have a talk at University of California, USC, where Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale met. And Robert Zemeckis went up to see Steven Spielberg after he saw the film and just said, I really enjoy it. I'd love to be a filmmaker. I'd love to be a director. Can I, you know, chat with you sometime? And Steven Spielberg invited him to his office. So that was a relationship that had existed since the 70s. And Steven Spielberg was an executive producer on I Want to Hold Your Hand, which was a film that the Bobs did together. And then the follow-up film, Used Cars, which was out of Columbia, Steven Spielberg was also executive producer of that film. And when it came time to shop around Back to the Future, the Bobs didn't want Steven to be associated. They were actually afraid, because those two films didn't have a high box office gross, weren't really a success. They were afraid that they would gain a reputation of just being allowed to burn studio money because they are friends with Steven Spielberg. And so Robert Zemeckis was able to get a job directing Romancing the Stone. It was a really horrible experience, actually. He was almost fired. Well, actually, he wasn't almost fired. They almost pulled the money from him. The studio, I believe that was Fox, the studio hated the test footage. They actually fired him from directing Cocoon, which he was supposed to direct. And then the film was a hit. Okay. So that enabled him to do Back to the Future, and he decided to go back and work with Steven Spielberg, who was always interested in the project and would have been involved had he not withdrawn himself under the Bob's request.
It's the funny part about Romancing the Stone is, like you say, it was sort of, even going in, I don't think the studio had any real idea what they were trying to do, and the film that comes out of it was another one of those runaway hits that I suspect nobody expected to happen, or at least it didn't seem like it was going to be the hit it became. So there's no question that Bob Zemeckis definitely helped himself and his cause with what he was able to do with Romancing the Stone. Of course, the good thing is Ron Howard did okay with Cocoon too, so
right.
At least that film got a good send off as well, even if Bob Zemeckis wasn't involved.
You know, it's worth mentioning. Because I asked Bob Zemeckis about this, and I asked him about, you know, if you had the ability to make Back to the Future before Romancing the Stone, do you think the film would have turned out as well as it did? And he really, he's a really reflective person and acknowledged that Back to the Future was as good as it is because it was his fourth film, because he had learn things through trial and error on I Want to Hold Your Hand and Used Cars and Romancing the Stone. And that by the time he had done the first Back to the Future, and especially the sequels, because after in between Back to the Future and the two sequels, he had done Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which, you know, I'm sure anyone who graduates from doing Who Framed Roger Rabbit can direct any film. that's a beast of a movie. He said he really felt like he had a handle on filmmaking. He was still sort of learning as he was going on those first couple of films. And it's not so much that I think Bob Zemeckis would even say, you know, things worked out the way they were supposed to in terms of the timeline.
Well, given some of the other issues that he ran into as far as the film was made, I think the fact that he did have Steven Spielberg knew he could not only was a good filmmaker, but they could also depend on Steven Spielberg to help them when their problems did appear. And of course, as we know, not just the first film, but each of that there were problems and other issues related to casting and some of the other problems that you mentioned in the book. And so definitely having Spielberg available to them as to assist them as needed on some of these issues was definitely important to the overall success of the trilogy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's an invaluable asset.
And so one of the things I wanted to ask you about before we talk about some specific examples from the book, how did you put together the book itself? Obviously you talk about it in the introduction of how you were able to talk to so many people and you had access to archives, but what was there a specific way that you followed, a specific form that you followed to try to see who can I get in touch with? Were you able to find one person who helped you with other people? Or how did the overall research process go for you?
It was really all of the above, actually. You know, as I mentioned in the book, I learned very early on in working on my first book that every single person involved in production has a story to tell. And, you know, I didn't speak to anyone in craft services, but I'm certain that if I spoke to someone in craft services, they would have interesting stories to tell from the set too. So the first, for this particular book, I reached out to a gentleman named Stephen Clark first. And Stephen Clark is the executive director at backtothefuture.com. And I interviewed him and just sort of got an overview. Frankly, I wanted to make sure that I understood the arc, sort of the narrative arc of the creation of these films in the same way that he did. And I guess what I mean more clearly is, as much as I love these films and own several home video iterations of them, you know, I don't go to DeLorean car shows. I you know, I don't do cosplay or anything like that. So, you know, someone who is much more connected, into the fan culture and the culture of these films, I wanted to make sure that in my initial research, I had sort of gotten it right in broad strokes. And, that was a good conversation with Steven. And Steven said, well, you know, I'm a great resource, but you really have to speak with Bob Gale. And I said, I'd love to speak with Bob Gale, but I've looked online. I don't really have a way of getting a hold of him. And Stephen was helpful in brokering an introduction for the two of us. And then after that, you know, Bob Gale was an incredible resource. I mean, I hope people who read the book appreciate sort of some of the smaller details, you know, signs that were outside of the Amblin offices, or what the layout of the editing room was like, or something like that. And a lot of those small details sort of come from Bob Gale's, either his records or his recollections. And he is really, he was a fantastic resource for this book. And through, while I was corresponding with Bob Gale and with Stephen Clark, I reached out to several of the other actors. Some of them said, absolutely, I'd love to speak with you. Some of them said, you know, I'll speak to you if someone else speaks to you. And so I sort of played, you know, followed those threads. And I didn't want to do it too much because I didn't want to take advantage of the opportunity. But every once in a while, I would really need to or want to speak to someone. And I would have to ask, you know, Bob or Stephen to broker an introduction for me. And they were, by and large, willing to do that. So I was able to speak with most everyone I wanted to for this book, which is really sort of astonishing considering so many of them are busy people. I don't know if most everyone notices this, but, or realizes this, but, you know, the crew that worked on Back to the Future, by and large, they all still work. I mean, these were amazing visual effects, special effects, stunt people. You know, there's almost no one associated with this film who is just, you know, sitting back and collecting royalty checks. They're all working still. So they were busy, and a lot of people made time for me, and the book is better for it, and I'm appreciative for it.
Yep. The good thing is that it helped you in this particular case. It's, even though it's 30 years ago, as you point out, most of the people, especially the major players, are still around and, as you say, working. So getting a hold of them. I guess the person who most impressed me as far as who you were able to talk to had to have been Christopher Lloyd. I don't know, but I get the impression he's not somebody that does a lot of interviews. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I just felt like, given how important he was to the series as a character and also as an older actor, when you consider the general young age of so many of the people on the set, that being able to talk to him definitely had to have helped the process quite a bit.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm very proud of that interview, and you are correct. It was a little bit, I don't want to say challenging, but he doesn't do a lot of interviews. So that was really great to have him on board. And again, I think he was very, very forthcoming with me, and the way that he comes across in the book, at least in my view, is, you know, really as a person, you know, I revere Christopher Lloyd with the utmost respect, lifelong fan, always will be. And, you know, I just think that he had a very human reaction to what it was like when they let go of Eric Stoltz, what it was like working on the sequels, his own nerves and trepidations and anxieties about playing Doc Brown in different iterations. I was really proud of that interview. I was really proud to speak with Bob Zemeckis, because I am such a fan of his work. Bob Zemeckis has not made a film that I don't like. So that was fantastic. And then also, it's sort of maybe not an obvious one, but the other person I was really proud to speak with is Sid Sheinberg, who almost never, I mean, I don't know if he ever does interviews on Back to the Future. I've looked online. I could not find anything. I called, and it was a very hard time to get that interview, just because of scheduling. And some days he would say he wanted to do it. Some days he didn't want to do it. And some days we'd have an appointment, and some days, you know, he'd be pulled into a meeting. And so I never thought it was going to happen, to be honest with you. And then when it did, he was, again, so forthcoming, so honest. You know, I didn't want to, it wasn't worth it for me to write this book if I was going to give information that everyone had already heard. So the more people that I could speak with, especially people who don't do lots of interviews and who are important to the making of these films, the better. And I think the film is better for it. I wish I had an opportunity to speak with Eric Stoltz. I made attempts, and I can certainly understand why he was disinterested. But I think that would have just been a fascinating thing, just for the sake of history, to sort of chronicle that.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because since I was not, I loved the film and everything, but I didn't know as much of the background until I actually read your book. So I guess I was one of the people who did not know that there was a change in the actor. But it is interesting, though, going back, that Michael J. Fox was always their first choice. They just couldn't get him originally because of his TV show. When we've heard that from other actors, too, the famous stories of actors who were supposed to be in certain roles but were blocked because of other work. Right. So they picked Eric Stoltz because they thought it was going to work. And you really go into a lot of depth about what it was like at the point where which they were about to make the change and leading up to it. And it was interesting to read about what it was like, as you pointed out, on set when the changes first occurred. And what was it like? What were some of the things that you were told things changed on the set once the actor was recast?
Well, one of the things that, sometimes you, when you're speaking with people, you anticipate the answer that you think they will give. And I asked every single person that I spoke to, when Eric Stoltz was fired and Michael J. Fox came in, weren't you afraid that this film was going to be ruined? And not one person said yes. You know, everyone said that they were actually, one of the editors, Arthur Schmidt, put it to me so wonderfully, where he said, I read the script. I knew what the movie was about. I was not in a position to question Eric Stoltz's performance. And in fact, I had no reason to question it, because I thought, who better to know the character of Marty McFly than Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale? So if they cast him, this must be what they want. And so everyone had sort of made their peace with Eric Stoltz playing that role. And when Michael J. Fox came in and they saw, wait a second, this scene could get a laugh, and this scene has a different energy, and this scene is making Christopher Lloyd change his performance in a positive way, and now there's physical humor. There was Eric Stoltz was really opposed to doing physical humor. There was one, I don't remember if this story's in the book, it might not be actually, but there was this one moment where he's in Lorraine's bedroom, and the character of Marty McFly is in Lorraine's bedroom, Lorraine played by Leah Thompson, and Eric, or the character Marty rather, pulls up his pants and sort of falls out of frame. And Eric Stoltz couldn't understand why he would fall. He's put on pants before. Why would he fall? And Zemeckis said, well, because it's funny. And Eric goes, yeah, but it's stupid. Like, why would he fall? I mean, people put on pants every day. People don't fall every time they put on pants. Like, what's the reason for him falling? And there were these sort of squabbles that Eric would get into, because he wanted it to be a serious performance. He wanted it to be a real performance. He wanted it to be grounded in, he wanted it to be nuanced to an extent. And one of the things that Michael J. Fox does so beautifully in the film is he keeps the sensibility light. He keeps it moving. You don't get bogged down in the intricacies of the story. Lots has been written online about sort of paradoxes in the film, or inaccuracies in terms of theories of time travel or things like that. And most viewers don't even notice or care about those things, because Michael J. Fox and the rest of the cast keep such a fluidity to the story. But Eric was not doing that. And so they all welcomed the change, with the exception of Leah Thompson, actually, who was at a point in her career where she was starting to have some big screen success and really was offended that they had hired a sitcom actor to be a part of this Steven Spielberg film. You know, she was sort of, the word that she used, I think, was snotty. She was sort of snotty and didn't really want to interact with Michael until she started working with him and realized that he was making the film better.
To this day, I wonder how the Indiana Jones movies would have been like had Tom Selleck been able to get out of Magnum PI and appear in the films like they wanted him to.
Yeah. And then it's funny. You know, you can play that game all night long with lots of films and just sort of playing, would it have been better? It's an interesting question.
Of course, one of the things you pointed out as part of your discussion of the changeover is that Bob Zemeckis and I assume other people claim that there's no footage at all in the film that included any scenes that would have included Eric Stoltz. Is that what they're saying?
That is what they are saying.
Because you didn't really want to come out and say you believe that completely.
I didn't put this in the book because I don't think that it's not provable, or at least it's not provable for me, and I don't know if it's provable really for anyone, but the editors are absolutely positive that there is no footage from Eric Stoltz in the film. The Bob Gale was less certain. Bob Gale said that he is pretty sure that there is no footage of Eric Stoltz. I would imagine that legally, they would have, you know, legally, I'm sure the answer is no. There is no footage of Eric Stoltz. But several of the actors and camera crew said that they really only shot what they needed to. And that there are two points in the film that I believe are Eric Stoltz. And it's just, you know, my opinion based on my interviews and just my freeze frame and also based on the production materials too, in terms of, you know, what scenes were shot when in the timeline. But at one point Marty punches Biff in Lou's cafe in the first film, and that's the 1955 cafe, and you can see very clearly that the eye line of Tom Wilson, who plays Biff, is much higher than it would be if it were Michael J. Fox, who was much shorter than Eric Stoltz. And so it is either a case of a stunt double or another double being too tall, or it is not Michael J. Fox or Michael J. Fox's double. The other moment is towards the beginning of the film when Marty jumps into the DeLorean before, as the Libyan terrorists are chasing him, the person that jumps across appears to be much taller than Michael J. Fox. Michael J. Fox's stunt double is Michael J. Fox's height. And so because you cannot see the face of the actor in that moment, I've been told by people that that is Eric Stoltz. And it certainly appears to, like I said, at a minimum, not be Michael J. Fox and not be Michael J. Fox's regular stunt double.
You got to give credit to the producers and everybody that they've been able to keep any of the footage of Eric Stoltz from ever appearing any place. I mean, these days you see these things sort of leak out, and it's interesting that they've been able to keep it out completely, and I'm sure we'll never see any of that footage, at least in any time in the future to the, you know, recent future.
It's kind of amazing. You know, and this is something that Robert Zemeckis has spoken about in interviews before, and he reiterated it to me. It's one of those things where Robert Zemeckis feels completely responsible for Eric Stoltz being cast. The analogy that I'll give is it would be like if you cast Meryl Streep in Sister Act. You know, Meryl Streep is a fantastic actress, but I don't know if she would be the best person to play that part in Sister Act, for example. I mean, maybe, but maybe not. Or, you know, Melissa McCarthy's part in Bridesmaids or something like that. You know, it's not, Eric Stoltz's performance in Back to the Future is not a referendum on him as an actor overall. However, Zemeckis and his producers are aware that it's almost impossible to tell the story of Eric Stoltz without the takeaway for the general public being that Eric Stoltz was so bad he needed to be fired, and thus making it a referendum about him as an actor. And so they don't want to do that, especially to someone who's still working. So that's probably why that footage will never see the light of day in a large portion.
Of course, Thomas F. Wilson, from some of the stories you told, was definitely happy to see Eric Stoltz go because of his method acting, and particularly as it relates to shoving and hitting Thomas F. Wilson's character.
Yes, that's kind of a crazy story. But Eric Stoltz is a very serious actor, you know, and I don't say that facetiously. He's a serious actor. He's a studied actor, studied with Stella Adler, who is a revered acting coach. And, wanted to be, he subscribes to the method. So he wanted to be called Marty on set. The only people who didn't call him Marty were some of the crew members that called him Rocky, which is his character in Mask, the film that he had shot right before Back to the Future. He took his job very seriously. And that included the day where in the Hill Valley High cafeteria, Eric Stoltz had to shove Biff, Tom Wilson's character, and ended up really making an enemy of Tom Wilson and bruising him pretty badly.
So let's start to look at part two now. But of course, once again, we have a casting for a set of movies that ended up overall very well. Back to the Future, the trilogy, definitely had its issues that could have derailed the movie in many ways. What was the whole controversy with Crispin Glover's character and his either unwillingness or inability to come back for the sequels?
The main issue with Crispin Glover is that Crispin was a very polarizing figure on the set of the first film. The actors, by and large, loved him. The crew, by and large, were annoyed by him. And, Bob Gale said to me he is able to divorce Crispin the person versus, Crispin as he appears on screen. He thinks that Crispin does a great job in Back to the Future, and still, despite sort of the a strained personal relationship that the two have, still really enjoys watching Crispin. But, Crispin was a headache. And so when it was time to do the sequels, you sort of had a situation where the filmmakers were not all that eager to work with Crispin again. And Crispin was not all that eager to sign back on. I guess the simple way of telling the story is the two sides sort of played chicken with each other, where Crispin knew that that George McFly in some capacity would be essential to the story. And so Crispin kept asking for more money at the same time that Bob Gale kept writing the character more and more out of the script. And so it finally reached a point where George McFly as a character was in so little of the script, and Crispin was asking for so much money that the deal was not going to go through. And they ended up replacing Crispin Glover with a character actor named Jeffrey Wiseman. And Jeffrey Wiseman was really mistreated on set. Certainly, his feeling is that he was mistreated on set. And I think, Leah Thompson certainly corroborates that she wasn't really happy to have him there. And there were things like, people would refer to him as Crispin on set, and Leah would refer to him as the actor who's playing Crispin, as opposed to the actor who's playing George McFly. Ultimately a lawsuit resulted because of this casting. I forgot to mention an important component of this story, which is in order to make the audience believe that Jeffrey Wiseman either was Crispin Glover or at least have the visual be the same, they put Jeffrey in Crispin Glover's facial appliances. So his latex makeup from the first film his old age makeup, so that he actually resembled Crispin Glover. And Crispin ultimately sued for that they misappropriated his likeness.
You actually have a pretty good detail of that whole story, including Weissman's own contribution to that problem, is, and people can read about it in the book, but it's clear that the whole thing did not go well, and it's a testament once again that they were able to put together a movie, a well-made movie, even with that kind of situation going on in the background. Of course, as you say, a lot of that has to do with, okay, all we have to do is write the script so that George isn't that important, and that helps us a great deal as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's, you know, one of the things with the sequels, too, is that they, the Bobs really wrote themselves into a corner. The ending of, you know, a lot of people believe that Back to the Future trilogy was always conceived to be a trilogy. It wasn't. The ending of the first film ends on a cliffhanger, but it was supposed to be sort of tongue-in-cheek. Marty spends so much of the film trying to fix up a problem with his parents, and then in the second film, or then the end of the first film, he has to fix a problem with his children. So it's sort of a play on this generational problem. But it painted them into a situation where they were locked. They could not start the story in good faith. 10 years later, 5 years later, they really had to pick up at that moment. That's what they believed audiences wanted to see. And so George McFly would have had to have played a part. And the character of Jennifer, who's played by Claudia Wells in the first film, and she was unable to appear in the sequels because of a personal issue with her mother, they had to recast that part. Elizabeth Shue filled in. And it was a necessary thing because of the confines of the ending of the first one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost, of course, I remember that, the difference when I saw the sequel the first time, and I said, wait a minute, that was before I knew all the background. I said, that doesn't look like the same person. And even though they did a pretty good job of making, of playing up the similarities between the two. But, of course, then we also had another major issue on the second film, and that was the stunt accident that you spend a lot of time in. The good thing is you were actually able to speak to the people who were major players in that aspect, in that part, and it was all related to these hoverboards again, right?
Right. That was, for me, I think that's actually the story in the book that I'm the most proud of. You know, if you watch the special features on the DVD, they mention so briefly, they mention, there was an accident or there was an incident when we filmed this scene and we had to shut down production for a couple of days. That's all they say. And so you don't really know what the nature of the accident is. You don't know why it was necessary that they shut down production for a couple of days. And so when I was speaking with the hoverboard actors, to be honest with you, and I know that this is probably not the best thing to say as an interviewer, but I was a little bit had a little bit of trepidation about broaching the accident with them. I didn't want to make it seem like it was, you know, I was looking to get a horror story from them. But these actors, it was impossible for these stunt performers and the actors that were on set to talk about Back to the Future without talking about the accident, because it was such a significant thing that that impacted their entire view of making this film. So, everyone that I spoke to would give me a little bit of information, a little bit of information, a little bit of information. And then they all said, well, you really have to speak to, you know, that's really Cheryl's story. Cheryl Wheeler is the name of the stunt woman who was dropped from 30 feet in the air and really almost died on the Hill Valley set. And everyone kept saying, well, it's really Cheryl's story to tell. You know, I don't want to get into it too much. It's Cheryl's story. It's Cheryl's story. And so when I called Cheryl, I said, you know, listen, I want to talk about Back to the Future. And obviously, I want to talk about the accident. But feel free to go into as much detail or as you want or gloss over, you know, if it's painful for you. And she said, no, please. It's a situation that changed my life. I'm happy to talk about it. And we had, say this affectionately, but it almost could barely be described as a conversation because I was so enthralled in the way that she told this story. I just listened. I mean, I had nothing to do but listen every once in a while, just ask clarifying questions. But it was quite amazing to me, everything. And then I, went back to the stunt performers and they filled in the gaps and they filled in sort of their perspective and sort of what led up to that stunt, because Cheryl Wheeler was not originally in the film. There was another stunt woman, Lisa McCullough, who was in Cheryl Wheeler's role. And then Lisa left because she was, she didn't like the way that the stunt was set up. And so as that, as I got a complete picture, I kept thinking to myself, okay, this is a fascinating story. And this gets into a little bit of like the craft of putting a book like this together. I didn't know. I knew I wanted to tell the story and it was a fresh story. So I wanted to tell it with some detail, but I didn't know if it could sustain an entire chapter. I didn't know how long a reader would be interested in knowing about this story. And so I wrote it. I wrote it long, I guess. And when I submitted the first draft, I'm pleased to say that that one section of the book is the section that was actually edited the least. That section of the book was, pretty much the way it appears in print is the way it was delivered on first draft. And that's just because, again, it was just such a great story. And I think, Cheryl told it in such a great way. And I hope that I captured it in a compelling way for the reader.
Well, the most interesting aspect to me, and unfortunately, given the time period in the 80s, that wasn't the, the stunt accidents, unfortunately, were occurring and pretty, and I don't want to say regularly, but there were a number of them. And the one good thing that came out of that, it seems to have been that the stunt group, professionals have done a pretty good job of cleaning it up, so to speak, so that you don't, some of the issues that Cheryl ran into, where she was, of course, being questioned when she was questioning aspects of the stunt and things like the fact that they had tested it, they had rehearsed it, and then they took it all down.
Right.
And put it back up before they filmed, and that's where she was first starting to say, this is scaring me.
Yeah. And
even though there are still stunt accidents, I feel like one of the reasons why we have movies now with stunts that are incredible so much is because the industry, so to speak, cleaned up the stunt performance aspects.
Yeah, I saw someone described for me that what happened during that hoverboard stunt accident is this theory that with every situation there is some risk. And very rarely do all of the worst case scenarios sort of line up. And in that case, I mean, luckily it wasn't the absolute worst case scenario because she is still with us. But it was really a perfect storm for a bad situation. As people can read in the book, there are a number of factors that maybe if just one of those factors had been different, the whole situation would have turned out differently. And who knows, maybe it wouldn't have, maybe it wouldn't have, but there were certainly a lot of changes that were made in the last couple moments before that stunt was done, a stunt that was already giving Cheryl trepidation and that gave Lisa McCullough trepidation enough to leave, weeks before the sequence was shot. So, there were warning signs, certainly, but, people had a lot of confidence, and the people that put that stunt together were seasoned veterans and trusted, blindly by a lot of people.
So then we come to the third film, which, of course, at the time was somewhat unusual in that even though it wasn't filmed, quote unquote, simultaneously with the second one, as we do see that happening sometimes now with some series films, but was filmed right after the second one was finished. It literally started, there was no real break between the two, if I've got that right.
Right, it was about 2 weeks.
How, and yet from reading the book, it seems like it was a reasonably quiet shoot, that the third film had the least amount of issues as far as the kind of problems we've talked about with the first two. And yet you would think that the concern would be, well, geez, we've been with this movie now for a long time, especially with two and three. How do you feel the third film was able to be successfully filmed without some of the issues that plagued the other films?
Well, I'm just as surprised as you. When I spoke with people and everyone said that part three was really a vacation, I think part of it is because they were away from Los Angeles. They went out to Sonoma or Sonora. I get them confused. I think Sonora, California. And they were out in, you know, gold country. It was quiet. So I think that's one aspect. Number two is Michael J. Fox. For a lot of the first film and most of the shoot of the second film, he was doing Family Ties, but Family Ties had come to its conclusion by sometime in between, sometime during the part two shoot. And so Michael was not running back and forth. I think also there were a lot of nerves about revisiting this Back to the Future material, but during the shoot for part three, Back to the Future 2 was already, you know, was already in the can. And so they sort of felt like it was like riding a bicycle. You know, they felt more confident. And the shoot for part two was so demanding with all of the hoverboards and especially, and we didn't really speak about it, but especially going back and revisiting the first film, looking at events from the first movie from a different perspective, that took a lot of work and a lot of skill. And it was very, very arduous for the cast and crew to make sure that there were little to no continuity errors. So it was a stressful shoot, that shoot. And so it was kind of a real resort like attitude. They had you know, sort of Olympic games that they played during lunch, and rode horses, and they had a really good time. It was a nice, almost victory lap for everyone working on those movies. A nice way to almost celebrate their work while they were still doing the work.
I wonder how much of the reasonably quiet atmosphere for the third one also was, because the second one hadn't been released yet, they didn't have to worry about, okay, what are we going to do? Because obviously, as you point out in the book, the second movie had its detractors, particularly those who didn't like the fact that there was no ending to it.
Right.
But I think maybe that helped too, in that they didn't have to try to one-up the second one because they didn't know what to expect because the second one hadn't been released yet. So maybe that helped as well. And you're right. I think part of it is it in comparison, particularly to the second one, it's a much quieter, you know, with fewer effects or stunt things that made such a big deal. You didn't have to try to pretend what the past looked like because you knew.
Right.
You didn't have to make up a brand new future like you did with 2015. Right. That we know now.
And isn't it funny that a film, you know, I always think that Back to the Future is Marty's film. Back to the Future 2, I think about as being like Biff's film, and Back to the Future 3 being Doc Brown's film. And I think it's so funny that the film centered around the wild-eyed, you know, scientist is the quietest film of the three. It's sort of incongruous to what you would think, but but yeah, somehow there's a beautiful calm to that movie.
What do you think, as we're starting to wind down, why is the series so popular? I mean, with all of your discussing with various people who are involved in your own viewing, is there something in particular that you feel makes the series to be so popular even today, where it's something that, you know, we're at the 30th anniversary, but people still love the films?
I think it's a couple of things. First of all, I think Back to the Future is one of the best ideas for a film. It's so simple, but it's so creative to take a teenager and have him go back in time and see his parents as teenagers and accidentally interfere with their meeting and have to fix them back up. Otherwise, it will threaten his own existence. I mean, it's just a smart, smart concept. And, you know, even with Eric Stoltz, or even if any of these things that ended up going right on the film hadn't, I would bet that it would still be a film that we would be talking about because of just the creativity of the concept. I also think that it was sort of perfect, the time period. You know, it came out in 1985. It takes place in 1985. But we are always nostalgic for the 1950s. It's a reason why every generation still loves the film Grease, you know, and everyone will. You know, there's something about that time period that's sort of magical for people. And so it worked out right for Marty to go back 30 years into the 1950s. And so much of that film is a period piece. And even if you watch the film today, you know, a child watching it today would see it as a period piece of the 80s. And it embraces its 80s-ness, you know, in a lot of ways. If you have slang in a film, or if you have product placement in a film, it dates it in a negative way. But because it's a film about time travel, Back to the Future will never feel old in that regard. And I think the third reason is just the time travel concept in and of itself. You know, people are always fascinated with time travel. You know, this idea that every event in your life leads to another event, and you know, if people had the opportunity to go back in time and give a piece of advice to their past selves, or change something about their lives, I'm sure most people would do that. Even if they knew there would be consequences, potentially, I'm sure most people would do it. And so I think Back to the Future, capitalizes on that curiosity and does it in such a fun way.
I think part of that related to that is the fact that I don't feel like the filmmakers, they treated the audience as intelligent. Yeah. They would understand that even though it was a comedy, and obviously that means sometimes you just do things for comedic effect, they were careful. So you see the changes of what happened, something as simple as the name of the mall changing between when Marty goes back and when he comes back because of the one pine being knocked down. And of course, the obvious things about the changes in his parents. But that's the kind of thing where you feel like the filmmakers decided, well, we want to show our audience that we've paid attention to all these things, that the details are important. And I think looking back and watching the film and seeing those things adds to its overall quality.
No, I agree with you. And, you know, again, I know I already made this point, but I keep bringing it up because I remain in awe of this myself. You know, these were filmmakers, Bob Zemeckis, Bob Gale, Neil Canton, Frank Marshall, Kathy Kennedy, you know, the people that were on set every day, because Steven Spielberg wasn't on set every day. You know, he was an executive producer, but these were filmmakers that made a film that frankly was better than they were at that point in their careers. I mean, I don't know if that's the right way to phrase it, but you know, you look at Romancing the Stone and you look at Back to the Future, and there is a world of difference between those two films. You look at Used Cars and you look at Back to the Future, and it's hard to believe that the same filmmakers made those films. You know, they all came together and showed up every day trying to make their best work. And they really did. And, you know, I think a testament to that, I saw the trailer for Robert Zemeckis' new film, The Walk. And at least in the teaser trailer, it starts with the text from Robert Zemeckis, director of Back to the Future, Forrest Gump, Castaway. And I don't know of any other director or any other director, especially director with a career as storied and successful as Robert Zemeckis, still celebrating a film that came out 30 years ago in the trailer for a new work. It's just a testament to how good that film is that Back to the Future leads. When you think about, you know, when they're trying to sell a film to an audience, they want you to think of Back to the Future as Robert Zemeckis' crown achievement.
Well, and you're right that the rest of the people that were involved were pretty good filmmakers too. I mean, I've heard of this Kathleen Kennedy before. I heard she's got some new film coming out in December.
Yeah, I can't remember what it's called.
It's something to do with stars, but I'm not sure. Battle Beyond the Star Wars or something. Anyway, so what are you working on? Do you have anything else in the pipe coming forward, or are you just going to be waiting for your next project to come along?
I have a project that I'm working on, but that's all I can say.
Yeah, I understand.
I will say that the project that I'm working on is it's less of a look at a particular film and more a look at a filmmaker and his career and the impact of that career on on the industry and the world. So it's more biography than sort of a look at a property.
I have to also ask you, do your students look at you in awe since you teach high school English, or do they think to yourself, we've got a published author for our teachers, or does that not really hit them?
I think it hits some of them. I just got a wonderful email from one of the book just came out yesterday. We're speaking on the 24th. Right. So I got an email from one of my students. The school year has already ended, but, she said, I downloaded your book on Kindle and I'm about three chapters in and you write pretty well. I thought that was
nice. Well, that's good.
I have her endorsement for the first three chapters at least. But you know, some of them have read my book. Some of them, for me, especially being a teacher of English, I talk about my books in class from the position of really craft and structure. And the importance of outlining, the importance of revising. It's funny because I think sometimes people look at books based on movies or books about, you know, making of books, and they go like, oh, well, that's a book about Back to the Future, and that's, you know, it's not like a real book or something like that. And, not just me, but every pop culture, cultural study book that I've ever read is a very serious book. You know, I as a kid read a book by Leonard Maltin on Our Gang, which is just fantastic. And when I spoke with Leonard Maltin for this book, I told him, you know, quite literally reading that book changed my life. I mean, that's not an exaggeration. I read a book by Mark Scott Zachary, The Twilight Zone Companion, and he read this book and wrote a nice comment that we put in the front of it. But the point that I'm making is that those are serious, serious books, and they take a serious look at these fun things. And so I talk about how it doesn't matter what you're writing about. It doesn't matter if it's a personal thing. It doesn't matter if it's a poem. It doesn't matter if it's silly. The idea is that you always have to take your work seriously. And if you take your work seriously, other people will as well. You know, the stupidest comedy film is done with a lot of seriousness behind the scenes. And so, write what you want to write, but always have integrity in your work.
Well, as I say, I'm looking forward to whatever you choose to do, because as I say, I'm going to have to go back and find the Christmas Story book, since I remember a little bits and pieces from actual filming. But thanks for talking to me. We obviously could have gone even longer, but I really appreciate the amount of detail. And you definitely wrote a fun book, but also a very informative book. And I hope fans of the series and reach out and read it, because it's definitely worth the time. And I hope that maybe someday I'll talk to you again about some future project.
Thank you. I hope to speak to you in the future. We'll end this with "to be continued."
There we go. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cassine, for speaking with me. I hope that fans of the trilogy find your book to be a great companion to the series. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film.